Accession number 18258, Reel 6.
Dance Reel 6.
Yes, three Germans. And they knelt over me. One of them gave me a drink of water from his water bottle, which was pretty good because I hadn't had a drink for days. And another one lit a German cigarette, Ersatz cigarette, put it in my mouth and nearly choked me because I'm not a smoker, as I say. So I had to spit that out, much to his annoyance. And then when they tried to carry me, they couldn't do it, and it was obviously tremendously painful. They disappeared, and they came back with an old broken-down pre-war motor car, which used to have running boards at the side. And one of them was driving it, and they had a blanket, and they lifted me up and laid me flat on the roof of this little old saloon car, threw the blanket over, then the other two, one stood on each running board, pulling the blanket down tight and holding on to the window to keep me on the top. And we set off. And of course the place was littered with shell holes, trees, and every time they hit anything like like a hole, it certainly put me through the mill, and I could hear the ones on the side shouting out to slow down. And eventually they got me to a main road that wasn't damaged, which was obviously some way out of the Arnhem area, and pulled in at the side of the road, and I could see German ambulances, and a German medical officer came forward and looked at me and looked at the shoulder and smelt it and asked me in German how many injections I'd had, and I didn't understand him fully, but I knew what he meant, and I said none. No, he said injections, and he produced a syringe, you see. I said no, nothing. He went away and he came back and he intimated he couldn't do anything about the wall, but he would inject into me. And it was like a horror film. He had this syringe which was about a foot long, and it was full of a yellow liquid. And he simply drove that into my neck here somewhere and squeezed the whole lot in. But of course he probably saved my life, because I found out afterwards that it was the only thing they could do to prevent gangrene setting in all over the place. It had obviously started, you see. So from there, I was loaded into a German ambulance, and this was, the excitement continued. There were four stretchers in a rack on that side and four on this side. This four was filled and these were filled, and they made the bottom one get out and get up one above so it could put me in there. I was the only British soldier in there. And we were on the road up to a place called Appledorn, which is north of Arnhem, quite a few miles. So I was in there for a time, and there was one SS dead opposite me, shouting and bawling. I took no notice of him until near the end I was getting fed up, and I said, "Oh, Deutschland kaputt," you know, and oh, God. Anyway, I was offloaded and put into this hospital, which I later found out was called the Queen Wilhelmina Hospital, a Dutch hospital, of course. And I was simply laid in the corridor on the tiles and left there. And they were treating Germans first. We had to wait, see. But every now and again, a Dutch woman would go by sweeping up and clearing up bandages and stuff. And again, you remember these things. This woman knelt by me, swabbing the floor and that, and she reached inside her skirt and pulled out a bit of bread with some cheese in it, you know. And I took it and grabbed it and covered it up. And she walked away and I was trying to eat this, you know. So that was one good move. Then I was moved onto a staircase and laid out on there. And then into an operating room. And I was simply laid down on the floor in the operating room. And they went to lift me up on the table. Now there was a couple of German doctors and two or three Dutch doctors and nurses. And the place was a shambles, you know. They were operating very quickly, but just clean-up operations, you know. And I was just about to go up, and they put me down again, brought this German in, got what was left of his boot off, and his foot was smashed. And they put him to sleep, and then they started sawing across here, to take all the front part of the foot away and just leave the heel bone. And he sat bolt upright in the middle of it and screamed. And I'm laying on the floor next to it. When I did get up on the table, the Dutch doctor said, "We give you more." Not so much him, you know. Obviously, they hadn't given him enough to put him right out. Anyway, they put me out. And when I came to, I was in a bed in the hospital with paper bandages, if you can imagine this, like toilet rolls. That's all they had, see. And I was swathed in this, and this shoulder was hurting like mad. But at least I knew I'd been cleaned up. And then a German came round to each bed and was saying, "Vier Jahren, vier Jahren." And, you know, I told him my age. And that, he got to the next bloke to me. He was a very young paratrooper. And he said, "Vier Jahren" to him. And the bloke was in trouble, you know, he was very weak. He'd had his leg removed, you see. And he was laying there, and I looked at him, I said, "He's asking you how old you are, mate." He said, 19. So, 19. Oh. And the German said to me, "Oh, he's so young," or something in German, you know. But that was enough for him. He'd got his name and that, his dog tag, and he knew how old he was, and that was that. But I spent a night there, and I thought, well, this is not bad. I'm going to see if I can get up in a minute. And I got up during the night. And because there were Royal Army Medical Corps orderlies on the ward, just one, to speak for us, and the rest were German. And I said, "Well, where's the nearest?" He said, "Down there, if you want, in through that door and to your left." And I staggered down there, you know, still. And I thought, well, if I can get in there, I can probably get out and disappear into the wilds, you know. And I thought, well, what I better do is go back and get my uniform on. But I couldn't get it on. I couldn't reach down. I couldn't do anything, you know. And so I had to give up that plan. And within hours, another German and a group of others came round. And Rouse, he didn't even look to see what your wound was. He just said, "Out." Whereas the young lad next to me, it was obviously a leg had been removed, you know, from the bedclothes. And he just passed him by. So... And then I got the order, you must get dressed and get up and you're going to march away. And I don't know how the hell I managed to march, but I did. And it was all the way out to a railway siding, into some cattle wagons and on the way into Germany. And well into that trip the next day, we were strafed by our own aircraft. And we thought, well, we may die that way now. But they flew away eventually, and we chugged on until we got to Hanover. And from there, we had to get out and march into Stalag 11B, X1B, at Fallingbostel, which was the outskirts of Hanover. And that was dreadful in there, dreadful. And I don't suppose I was in there 3 days, but my wound was getting worse. Everyone told me I was stinking, you know. I could smell it myself. But I couldn't get any treatment. And then they managed to get an RAMC officer into me. And he didn't move anything here. He just looked at my arm. And I could tell there was something wrong here. And what it was, a piece of my bone, like when you splinter a bit of green wood, a piece of the bone was up where it had been broken out by the shell fragment. And it was curling back out here. And of course, every time I moved, it touched it, it gave me a terrible feeling. And he said, "This is going to hurt." And he went away and he came back with an ordinary pair of pliers. And he asked two or three blokes to hold me. And he got hold of it and he pulled on it and kept twisting it, twisting it, twisting it, till he could break it off. And I think I went out by then, you know. But the next minute, I knew I was being told to get up out to the trains again. Now, they didn't send them all out, but they seemed to send quite a wad of glider pilots out. And I think it all depended on which truck you got into, you know, what happened to you from then on. But the trucks went rumbling on for a long time. We went through the outskirts of Berlin, and I was determined to see something of Berlin, to see what mess our lads had made of it, and it was a shambles. There were lots of land, of course, where they started growing crops, like allotments, and they put up like little allotment sheds, you know. But people, a family was living in them, because we were stuck there for hours, and yeah, there were slits in the side of the boards on the side of the wagon, and you could see through it, and I could see this little thing. And I watched, and a fella came out, very grey, with his briefcase, going off to work, and a woman and two little kiddies. And this thing was the size of a cupboard. They must have been sitting on the floor, stood up, you know, to get some sleep. Then we trudged on for a long way, and we went right down into Silesia, into southern Poland, and we stopped at the town of Sagan, S-A-G-A-N. And from there we were marched round the streets of Sagan with a lorry blaring that this is the famous 1st Airborne Division. Look at them, what a shambles. Because at that time they'd taken our belts away and our braces, and most of them boots. So you were walking barefoot, or trying to march, and holding your trousers up, you know. So it didn't make you feel very good. But eventually we ended up on the walkway up into this dirt track up into Stalag 8C at Sagan. And it was just on a big clearing of a big forest, very flat, very sandy ground, you know. And eventually we were ushered in there. And we were fell in out on this open area, parade ground, you'd like to call it. And we stood there for 4 hours. And then eventually a German came out and looked at us and walked away again for another hour. Then he came back and introduced himself as the camp commandant, SS, and that we were all terrorists and we would be disposed of. So it wasn't very nice there. They took all the straw away that could be used as bedding, took the bedboards away, which made you off the ground, and you're just sleeping on the ground. And of course, I was getting worse and worse. The shoulder was getting very bad and I was unconscious most of the time. But luckily, I had a few of my old glider pilot buddies there and they must have kicked up a stink, you know. And eventually, I came to and they were picking me up and putting me on a couple of planks. And it was snowing then. I always remember that. It was snowing hard. And they got me out the door, and one of them said something to me. We're going to get you up into the hospital hut. Well, I'd heard about this place. It wasn't much better than where you were, but it was called the hospital hut. And I can remember this being carried with the snow coming down on my face, and every now and again I almost rolled off the plank. They got me up to this hut, and in I went, and straight away a French chap came along, French prisoner, and he helped me to get onto a bed and get my trousers and stuff up and into the bed with one blanket and a bit of a sheet and a pillow of all things. And I thought, God, I'm in heaven here, you know. And then another young Frenchman arrived who I found out had been a medical student at university down at near Avignon, you know, the famous Sur le Pont d'Avignon. And when the Germans went down into southern France, they simply went into all the hospitals and said, you're doctors, you're a qualified nurse, over here, straight on a train into Germany. And they put a lot of them into prison camps. But of course, this young fellow hadn't completed anything like his full tour, as it were. And he looked at my shoulder and he said, puss, beaucoup de puss. I knew what he meant. And, you know, I don't want to upset anybody, but he went and got a pair of scissors and he pushed that right into the wound, closed, and then he opened them and pulled it out. And it came out like a Mount Vesuvius out of my body. I couldn't believe it, you know. And he said, oh, get better now, you know, this sort of thing. But it didn't. It blew up again. And in that hospital, he said, I'm going to have to operate. I must go in. There's something still inside your body. And they got me on a table one day and they put a strap round me and on my side and three other French prisoners who were told to hold me. and they tried to knock me out. And what it was a tin of, like a tape, paint tin, and it was full of amyl acetate, pear drop, you know. And of course the fumes of that can make you disoriented. And they held it. Keep your face down, and they held it and put something over my head, and I'm breathing these fumes. And of course, I didn't go right out, but I heard bongs and bangs in my head, and then I felt this red-hot pain in my shoulder where he was cutting. And once that was over, he was standing there, and he said, look what I find. And it was a square piece about that size of my uniform with the seam in it. Now, the seam ran straight down the back of the battle dress. I had the piece of stuff until several years ago. I lost the wallet, and that was in it, wallet, so I lost it. But it was a square piece of my battle dress tunic, all filthy and dirty. And that was right down, laying on the top of my lung. And it was because it was that was causing all the trouble. So it did start to heal after that, but so slow because we weren't getting the proper food. And the days went by and I was still in there. And again, it was about February of the year. Terribly cold, bitterly cold. And snow outside. You could always hear the main camp, which was a couple of hundred yards away, because the noise from the voices, so many people talking once, you get a noise. And this particular morning, it didn't sound so noisy. Now, there was one old German guard, he must have been 65, and he could speak a bit of English because he'd been a prisoner of war of the British in the First World War in this country, and he liked it here. He worked on a farm, he told me all about it. And he came and I said, what's up? Not so many. He said, some gone. So I thought, oh, they were overcrowded anyway. And the next day he came in and he said, I'm worried for my Frau. It's not for me. I've finished. He said, I'm finished, but my Frau. I said, what's wrong? He said, the Russians are getting near Breslau, which was about 30 miles away. Well, I knew that because we could hear the guns. And I said, well, why don't you go? You've done your duty in the First World War. You're 65 years away. You don't want to be here when the Russians come. Go home, get your wife, and head west. I think I do that, he said. I never saw him again. The next morning, there was no noise from the camp, and there was no noise in the hospital. But my old pal, two of them were there, Mick Pryor, because he'd had a back wound, and who was the other one? Stan Clough. And I said, Stan, there's something wrong somewhere. He said, I'm trying to find out. Anyway, we saw another guard, and we said, you know, comrade down there. Gone, all gone. They'd all been marched out, you see, to head west. And we were not fit enough, so they left us there. And within hours, I said to Stan, I'm not waiting here to be collared by the SS and just shot out of hand. There's hardly any guard round the camp. There's only one up at the gate. We could get through that wire somewhere. And anyway, we did. We got out. But I was so groggy, I'd been flat on my back for days. The others had been up and about a bit. But we got out. And we walked as far as we could away from the camp, in case the guard saw us and got us back. And we got onto a main road, and there were Germans still trickling along going west who took no notice of us. They'd got their own problems, including some German troops. So I said, well, they're going west. The Russians are not far away. You know, we can hear the gunfire. We ought to go that way. So we decided to go that way. So we went against the flow. And eventually we got to the outskirts of Breslau. And all we saw was a mass of Russian guns and tanks just sitting there, just all doing the same thing, all going, shelling into the middle. And by then Breslau was just pulp, you know. But they were out to destroy that place. And some of our blokes were unlucky, and the Russians made them carry ammunition for them, you know. But we got past them eventually. Still heading east, and we didn't see anyone then for a couple of days, just plodding along these roads in the cold, freezing cold, and something I never forgotten. You never seem to catch cold when you're in that sort of circumstance. You're too busy to catch cold, or you're too far gone, but you don't. You don't even remember going to the toilet and things like that, you know. But then we got to a bit of a hamlet, a farm and that, and I thought, well, I don't know, let's stop here. And we stopped and we searched for any potatoes we could find, but we couldn't find any. Because, you see, what had happened, the Germans had taken what they could carry, and then the advancing Russian troops had picked it all clean. And I thought I heard a chicken crow round there, round the back of those buildings in that wood. So we went round there, and we didn't see a chicken, but we saw a horrible sight. There was a duck pond there, fair size, you know. And it was frozen solid, of course. I mean, the temperature then was about minus 20 or something like that. And in a line across the pond were German soldiers, all frozen in death. One had gone down and was through the water and his backside was just showing. But next to him was a bloke going like that and he was frozen.
With his hands up to his face.
Yes, that's right. And others were just standing like that. But they were dead and they were frozen solid. And I said to the other, what a sight. I said, they must have marched them into that water to let them freeze. And then to finish them off, they machine gunned them, you know. That's why only one was underwater. The rest were already frozen. The bullet went into them. They were probably dead as well, some of them. But they'd all been hit. And they were just standing there, you know, crouching and in the falling. We tried to find this chicken. We couldn't. But we found some eggs, which we boiled in a little bath with some water we found, well, out the pond. Because most of the eggs were addled, they'd got chicks in, so we didn't eat them, but we munched a bit of the others. Back out on the road, I think another day must have gone by, crawling along, because I couldn't walk very fast, and we were picking up odd stragglers, strangers, including three Indian troops, who'd been employed as prisoners on farms. And the farmers had said, well, we're going, you do what you like. Go down that road and meet the Russians. Instead of that, they met us, but they insisted on joining us, you see. And there were others, British troops, who'd worked in little factories and farms, who'd come out, you know. So I don't know what the number was eventually, but it must have been getting on to 40 or 50 strong. And we went on. And then suddenly we started meeting Russian troops in some sort of organised form. And then we met a mass of them coming, marching each side of the road, single file, with odd vehicles. And they were a rough-looking lot. They really were. They didn't seem to have any discipline, but they were human beings, and they had weapons. And they'd soon got used to what to do, you see, and one of these blokes detached himself and came over to me and started to signal for me. No, next, Deutscher. Deutscher took him away, you know, got rid of him. Went on a bit further, and the mass of troops stopped, but a little party came by, and I swear blind they'd been drinking petrol because they stunk of it, and they were literally paralytic, and one of them came up to me, and he was pointed to my watch on my wrist, which I'd still got. And he wanted that. And I said, no, it's no good, you know. And then the ring that Maisie gave me before our marriage, I've still got it on my finger now, worn out. And he's trying to pull that off. And then he banged my head and he put the muzzle of the machine gun into my mouth. And, you know, I swear blind he would have blown my head off. But at that moment, you know, he was started looking at my chest. And, of course, I'd got my old battle dress on. I'd still got my wings on it. And I'm saying, Deutsch, nein. English, nope. And I was pointing to the crown in the middle of the wings. And it seemed to get through to him. And thank God he took the thing out of my mouth. Then more troops started coming along. And he moved off. And with them was an officer mounted on a bloody old cart horse, you know. He was in mud up to here, but He was dressed immaculately, had the most luxurious overcoat on, with great square shoulders and all his badges and rank and a beautiful hat. And he looked at us, and he laughed, and he pointed out, he said, "English." And I said, "Yes, English." "Ah, where are you from?" I said, "Prisoner camp." Told him, "Where you go?" I said, "Russia." "Very difficult," he said. "I have been in London, you know." And then he's still sitting on his horse above us. And he looked round and he just singled out one poor devil going by in all this mess. Called him over, and in Russian, he must have said to him, "You're going to escort these people back to Russia. But get as far as you can and try and get them to a rail point." And I heard him say Katowice, you know. I thought, "Well, I know that. It's a German coal mining area, you know." So this fella, he said, "Good luck." And off he went on his cart horse, and all the rest went by. And this chap joined us and went with us. So we felt a good deal safer then. But of course, he had no food with him or anything. So when we found food, boiled some potatoes up, we always gave him some, you know, because he had no rations. And eventually we reached Katowice, or Katowice as they call it. And there was a big Russian garrison in the town, you know. And there, they got this woman out, great big hefty woman who was supposed to be a Russian doctor, who looked at me, and my left knee was the size of a football. I was skin and bones, of course, but my knee was so big I couldn't move my trouser leg either way. And she felt it and said, "Oh, nothing I can do anything." Gave me a couple of aspirins, put me in a bed. Are we getting near the end?
Sorry.
And she said, "You stay there, you know." So I stayed there, but Mick Keeley was there and Stan Clow, and I said, "For God's sake, where are you going?" He said, "They're putting us on a truck, taking us somewhere." I said, "Well, if you can, don't leave me here. I'll never be heard of." Anyway, I fell asleep, of course, in laying on a bed. Next thing I knew was I was being woke up, and I was staying, and Mick were there. "Come on, quick, wear your boots," you know, because you're just in the bed with all your gear on. Boots were still there, thank goodness. "Get them on. Don't worry about tying them up." They carried me out and got me up onto this lorry. I said, "Well, what's happening now?" They said, "We don't know. They just told us to get on the lorry." So I thought, "Well, thanks for coming back for me." They said, "Well, we had a job to find it, you know." And that we drove off and went out to a railhead of sorts, you know, because out there was a big Russian train, all cattle wagons, and they were told to get on there, with lots of other prisoners who'd been assembled in the area. That's British, American, French prisoners, you know. And we got into these wagons, and within seconds you're going, "God, like this, lice." So I said, "For Christ's sake, you get your vest and everything off, get a sliver of wood and burn under your arms, because they'll lay the eggs under there. And don't scratch the bites, you know." So it was terrible, really, but we tidied ourselves up as much as we could. And in the wagon was a big stove in the middle of the floor, a big sliding door. And then there was a layer of straw and muck on the floor. And then there was some timbers going up. And there was another layer up here. And another layer, if ever you saw the film of Dr. Zhivago, they showed it pretty well there. And there was one bucket. But the train went for several days and it didn't stop, you know. So you can imagine what it was like. Anyway, what with the lice and everything, but we started chugging along, but terribly slowly. And we found out that the engine kept breaking down and they had to carry out.